Hey there, listeners. Happy holidays and sending you well wishes for a new year in 2022. My name is Tim Hines. I'm the Coffee Education Manager here at the Center, and I always enjoy finishing up a year and looking with excitement and anticipation to the year ahead. I had the incredible opportunity of ending my 2021 with a 10-day Queue Processing Level 3 intensive course organized by the Coffee Quality Institute and hosted at Hacienda Alsacia in Costa Rica. This course brought together over 20 coffee professionals from 14 different countries and a host of speakers, lectures, and more. As I sat through the sessions over the 10 days, I could not wait to share some of this information with you. I always end my episodes with the charge to keep learning, and I'm excited to share with you today the lessons I learned during this course. Join me today as we dive into a range of topics that will be sure to pique your interest. Coffee Quality Institute, CQI's, Queue Processing Level 3 is the highest level of the processing program focused on creating processing specialists that are working to shape the industry as a whole. Pioneered by Dr. Mario Fernandez, who's now with the SCA, and now driven forward by the brilliant Joel Schuler, this year-long course is structured into three parts. There have been three cohorts of participants for this course, and each one is an amazing mixture of industry leaders that personally I'm honored to learn and grow alongside. The intensive in Costa Rica was a bit different than the previous one, as we were given a challenge at the beginning of the course to consider the coffee farmer of year 2050 and answer a few questions. What will a successful coffee farmer look like in 2050? And what do we need to be doing now to help train and equip farmers to success in the future? I, together with my great friends Leo and Johan from Indonesia, were tasked with considering the situation in Indonesia. But other groups considered East Africa, Southeast Asia, Colombia, Brazil, and Central America. In order to consider various topics and challenges facing these individuals, Joel Schuler, our course instructor, brought together some of the world's leading voices in our industry. These included Tere Esteve from Ecom, Tim Scharrer of Starbucks, Venusia Naguria of the Brazil Specialty Coffee Association, Dr. Adriana Farrar, professor and coffee researcher from the University of Rio de Janeiro. Her book on coffee production, quality, and chemistry is fantastic. Christophe Montagnon, a well-known coffee geneticist researcher, Gerard Bitoff, and many, many more. But one particular amazing opportunity we had was the pleasure to have Dr. Flavio Barrain with us for several days. I'm excited to share more with you about what he shared regarding drying and storage. Dr. Barrain truly is an amazing professor, researcher, and really just a delightful human being. To be honest, his involvement alone would have made this course worth its weight in gold. We began our week with a very high-level macro discussion on the trends, directions, and challenges facing coffee farmers. Teddy of Ecom, Tim from Starbucks, and Venusia from the BCSA all mentioned the challenges facing coffee farmers with issues like labor shortage and the lack of economic sustainability for those farming under 1 hectare of land and solely relying on coffee as the main source of income from that land. Leaning on the report by Jeffrey Sachs, as well as the trends they are seeing, those smallholder farmers who are working on less than 1 hectare of land need to consider diversification or consolidation into larger farms. Jeremy Dufour, Global Sustainability Project Manager for Olam, echoed the need for farmers to consider a diversity of income streams, as relying solely on coffee will not be economically sustainable for a large number of smallholder farmers. As we dive down into this and understand better what this means for smallholder farmers, there are several considerations we must make. What type of agronomy training will these smallholders need to diversify into new crops? What market will there be for those crops? How will they finance a transition away from coffee to new crops? There will be education and training needed to support farmers in that transition. Ultimately, we must remember that we're not talking about the farmers who are anaerobically fermenting their coffees or competing at the upper levels of COE competitions or making their way to coffee shows across the world. No, these are isolated producers with limited access to markets and oftentimes selling cherry or wet parchment into local supply chain structures. I'm encouraged that it does seem many multinational companies are understanding this need to provide training and have projects specifically targeted supporting farmers' transition away from coffee. And while these smallholders are isolated, in my opinion, we see this degree of isolation being eroded little by little as access to technology and educational extension services continue to expand throughout the world. Another topic of conversation that came up many times in our macro level discussion was the need for producers to premiumize or customize for a changing and growing market. In general, we have seen the evolution of this from beginning with certifications like Rainforest Alliance, Fair Trade, and Organic that offered an incentive to producers, of which the effectiveness we can discuss at length, to now we see this in the way of post-harvest processing. Producers premiumize their product through different processing methods that develop different flavors. However, as we looked at this idea of premiumization for the future, there are several things that we identified and discussed during our course. We see a decline in certifications like Rainforest Alliance, Organic, Fair Trade, and a shift toward more carbon neutral, greenhouse gas emissions, and other types of these kinds of certification schemes. Our hope is that the advance of technology, as well as accessibility to information, allows these certifications to be democratized and the expense to be greatly reduced from what they currently are. While it is understandable that the verification of standards is a crucial part of the current certification programs, my contention is that there needs to be a more economically sustainable way to provide these verifications without producers having to expand large amounts of finance to receive them, especially if the financial benefit of having them is not well above and beyond the cost. As we continue to expand and learn more about post-harvest processing, we see the next frontier centered on the exploration and proliferation of producers customizing flavors and coffees for the end user. I don't want to get sidetracked here by the notions of terroir and more, but personally, I see in the future that we will have producers from within one producing country able to offer a wide variety of flavors and a portfolio of products. And let's be honest, we're already seeing this, and I believe we will continue to see this expand as the knowledge about post-harvest processing and understanding of the process expands. I really want to dive in here about the C market, pricing, supply chain, and more, but I'm working on an episode that will be released in the coming months where I will dive into this. But I will make one mention here that was a particularly insightful comment that Venusia shared. She articulated the need in the industry to focus our conversations concerning economic sustainability away from pricing and toward margin. This doesn't mean we don't talk about pricing, but her point was that the conversation cannot end there. Margin takes into consideration cost of production, living income, living wage, and other components than just merely pricing. Personally, I've grown frustrated a bit that conversations around equitable distribution of value in the supply chain seem to focus on the percent of retail value that coffee producers make. While I believe we wholeheartedly have to press into this understanding more, we also need to be careful because the statistic of percent of retail value of coffee lacks context. It lacks understanding of regional specific supply chains, and it lacks consideration of value creation and many more topics. Like I said, I've been working on an episode on this topic and will be sharing more in the coming months. As we step down from the macro perspective and thinking about the future, several speakers shared about recent innovations and technologies in coffee, and I want to share some of those with you. Our discussion around carbon neutrality, climate change, reducing greenhouse gas emissions, and more developed many questions. Can I first just say, though, that there does seem to be a heightened focus on the topic toward coffee producers around the world. Don't get me wrong. Of course, I'm all about reducing emissions, and initiatives of carbon neutrality are worthy pursuits. But if I'm not mistaken, coffee-producing countries around the world are not the world leaders in CO2 production. It would be great to hear more and more initiatives targeting this on the consumption end. Ultimately, it's a global problem that we all need to face together. And one more note, just as I believe we will see more and more focus on coffee sourced in this way, meaning those with certifications of carbon neutrality, wouldn't it be interesting if producers required carbon neutrality, or at least evidence of projects focusing on this, from buyers before they agreed to sell them their coffee? I realize there are limitations on this, but what if a requirement to participate in, say, a COE auction or a similar type of event was restricted to roasters or green buyers who can show their commitment to these ends? Just an idea. But back to what I wanted to share. A very interesting tool one of my fellow cohort members, shout out to Leo from Indonesia, shared was a website called coolfarmtool.org. It helps producers to be able to measure and track their carbon footprint. This becomes significant because, as several speakers shared, being able to quantify carbon neutrality is a huge step and has great advantages for all actors across the supply chain. You see, we are hearing discussions and mentions of carbon credits. However, these credits can only be claimed by one entity in the supply chain, whereas claims of carbon neutrality are shared across the supply chain and present real value for many actors. Being able to quantify the reduction provides producers with a huge opportunity to leverage that for greater value creation within their coffee and hopefully allow them to capture greater value. Other innovations included Leonardo Sanchez, who showed us the wastewater management system he designed at a local co-op in Costa Rica, where they utilize an anaerobic digester to create biogas and is one step in the process of cleaning their processing water in 24 hours. It was really impressive, and I hope to be able to share more about this in the future. We also discussed innovations with coffee processing, like the use of the Centriflux machine from Brazil, which is a type of mechanical demucilager that uses centrifugal force instead of friction, thus reducing mechanical damage to the seed. We also talked about coffee processing inoculations. Interesting to note that several producers who are performing inoculations are finding better success when inoculating in cherry as opposed to pulped coffee. This by no means is an across-the-board recommendation, but definitely something to consider. There were so many other great discussions, but I'd like to share with you the presentations given by Dr. Flavio Burim, as there was such rich value in his presentation. If you're not familiar, Dr. Burim is a full professor at the University of Lavras and has done extensive research and writing on coffee post-harvest processing. But equally impressive is his ability to take concepts and make them so practical. He was such a gracious and humble presenter, and while his presentations alone could fill an entire course, hint, hint, I want to share those highlights here with you. The keys to coffee drying and storage are twofold: maintaining seed viability and ensuring integrity of cellular membranes. In order to ensure coffees maintain at a high quality level and have an adequate shelf life, we must consider these two aspects in both drying and storage. As we begin to talk about drying, it's important to maintain a consideration on the impact of various vapor pressures on drying. At its core, drying is the ability to balance between the vapor pressure of the ambient air, vapor pressure on the surface of the coffee seed, and vapor pressure internally, inside the coffee seed. A significant contributor to the vapor pressure inside the seed has to do with the internal resistance of water movement throughout the seed. Essentially, water must be at the surface of the coffee seed to be able to be evaporated. However, in addition to this, if the vapor pressure of the ambient air, that is, the air around the coffee seed, is greater than at the surface of the seed, no evaporation will occur. In fact, if it's too high, saturation or absorption of moisture will occur. Therefore, Dr. Burim emphasized on debunking a popular practice in coffee drying, which is high heat at the beginning of drying. what his research and experience has shown is that we should reduce temperature at the initial stages of drying, say roughly 5 degrees Celsius above ambient temperature, but increase airflow to ensure a lower level of ambient vapor pressure. In fact, elevated temperatures at the beginning of drying represent a waste of resources, as well as potential damage to the seed. This practice should continue until the coffee reaches roughly 30% moisture content. Furthermore, in light of the understanding of water movement to the surface of the seed and the internal resistances increasing as water is evaporated, in other words, more time is needed for the water to reach the surface for evaporation, Dr. Brim highly recommends incorporating times of rest when drying coffee. Practically speaking, he recommends once reaching about 30% moisture content to rest for 12 hours. Then continue drying to roughly 20% moisture content and rest for another 12 hours. Then once you reach about 16% moisture content, you should rest for 24 hours and then continue drying down to 11%. During these times of rest, ambient conditions should be maintained. In other words, we don't need to cool down the coffee. We can leave the coffee covered on the raised bed, covered on the patio, or even left inside the mechanical dryer. But overall, bean temperatures during drying should never exceed 40 degrees Celsius, and really we probably should actually use 38 degrees Celsius as a standard, just to be safe. And drying rates should be on average about 0.5% moisture loss per hour. Now that's an average over the entire drying time. The recommendations he made above were specific to natural processed coffee, as Dr. Brim does work extensively in Brazil and works a lot with natural coffee, but they also hold for washed or parchment dried coffee as well. After drying is complete, coffee should rest around roughly 30 days before milling. In the midst of discussions about drying, we had an interesting discussion concerning the phenol defect. It always frustrated me as I looked for not only ways to identify and sort out this defect, but more so ways to prevent it. I would hear theories ranging from development in humid conditions during drying to develop during fermentation. Dr. Brim shared some incredible insights to this defect. As a researcher and professor in Brazil, Dr. Brim clarified that phenol and Rio are really the same defect, and he very strongly feels that the naming the defect phenol is misnaming. This defect presents as a medicinal or iodine-like sensory characteristic in the cup, and is a secondary metabolite produced by fungi. And get this, it is not even a phenolic compound. It develops when the coffee is in the 20 to 30% moisture content range and experiences extended high humidity environments. When the coffee is at this moisture content, the water activity is such that fungi development is encouraged. And when the coffee remains at this level for an extended period of time, those fungi produce compounds that lead to the development of this defect. The practical application of this would be that knowing which coffees are in this range when rainy or humid conditions occur can help you mitigate the occurrence or development of this defect. In all the discussions around certain moisture content levels and being able to track coffee as it progresses through drying stages, we talked about the inadequacies of the current technology for measuring moisture content. Anyone who has used these handheld capacitance devices can share with you their frustration on their inaccuracies. Dr. Brim shared our frustrations and offered a few helpful tips. 1. Make sure that you always measure hold coffee. For the most part, devices that measure coffee before it is hold are not accurate or consistent. 2. Make sure that the temperature of your coffee is brought down to ambient conditions before measuring. And 3, consider using the gravimetric way to measure moisture loss, as it is more accurate and relies on very low-tech equipment. For those of you that aren't familiar with the gravimetric method, I want to share more about this with you. Essentially, this method operates under the notion that coffee, as it dries, does not drastically change in the weight of dry matter. So, for instance, if I have 1 kilogram of green coffee at 11% moisture content, this means that 11% of the weight is water, and 89% of the weight is dry matter. This weight of dry matter does not change significantly enough throughout the drying of coffee. Therefore, we can use the weight loss attributed to moisture loss to estimate when the coffee is dried. If you've ever had experience with this method, let me know. Or if you want to learn more, please reach out. After discussions of drying, we discussed storage. The viability of the seed and integrity of the cellular membranes contribute to the rate of respiration of the coffee. An increased rate of respiration translates into a quicker degradation of quality. Our goal in storage is to minimize the rate of respiration through reduced temperatures, lowering humidity, and even increasing levels of CO2 in the packaging, which is done through having impermeable bags like high barrier plastic bags such as Ecotec, GrainPro, and the like. Dr. Barame shared with us his study that confirmed the negligible quality impact of vacuum sealing coffee as compared to high barrier plastic bags. This means one should truly consider if vacuum sealing is worth the investment. In addition, Dr. Barame shared some extremely insightful ways we can test seed viability and integrity as we consider the potential shelf life of the coffee. I'm currently working on some projects investigating these and look forward to sharing more in the future. Overall, this course was fantastic. The work of the organizers to bring together an amazing group of speakers, as well as the work of the instructor, Joel Schuler, and assistants, Louise from Fazenda, California in Brazil, and Francisco, a coffee farmer from Brazil, made the course such a delight. Almost a month removed from the course, I'm still thinking over and getting ideas down that I look forward to sharing more with you in the future. One of our passions here at the center is to ensure this kind of information can reach those who can benefit from it the most. If you have any questions or would like to know more, reach out to set up a time to chat. I am looking forward to 2022 and am excited to expand our course offerings to you. We have some exciting new courses that are available and will be releasing more in the coming weeks. I look forward to joining you in your educational journey. Thanks so much for joining me today and hanging around till the end on today's episode. Have a great day, and as always, keep learning.